From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Και τέλος, για πρώτη φορά, με τόσο ρητό και κατηγορηματικό τρόπο, προσδιορίστηκε η διαδικασία για την απομείωση του ελληνικού χρέους, που αποτελεί ίσως και τον πιο κρίσιμο κόμπο στην επίλυση του ελληνικού προβλήματος.
That was Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras in a televised address Thursday, announcing that he's decided to step down and call snap elections. According to a report from Reuters, which cited unnamed government officials, those elections will be set for September 20th. Prior to his announced resignation and call for new elections, Greece received the first tranche of its new $86 billion bailout. Once the Prime Minister submits his resignation, which he was set to do late Thursday, Tsipras will be replaced by the President of Greece's Supreme Court, Vasiliki Thanou Christofoulou, who's a vocal bailout opponent. He will then oversee the elections as the head of an interim government. Earlier Thursday, Finance Minister Euclid Sakalotos told Greece's broadcaster ERT that the election, quote, will not be the same as those of 2012 because now there is agreement and there is a framework for the recapitalization of banks, closed quote. Tsipras won parliamentary backing for the tough bailout program last week by a comfortable margin, despite a large-scale rebellion among members of his ruling Syriza party, with nearly one-third of the party's 149 members of parliament either voting against the deal or abstaining. Syriza governs in a coalition with the right-wing anti-austerity party Independent Greeks, or ANEL. The revolt by hardliners, angry at what they view as a betrayal of the party's pledge to fight austerity, left Tsipras short of the 120 votes he would need, being two-fifths of the 300-seat assembly, to survive a censure motion, and he was widely expected to call a confidence vote this week or next. He apparently decided to skip that step and go right to the country in an attempt to silence rebels in his own party and shore up public support for the three-year bailout program. Some observers speculate that Tsipras decided to call the elections before the effects of the new bailout measures, which include further pension cuts and tax increases, started to make themselves felt. Kostas Panyiotakis is a professor of sociology at the College of Technology of the City of New York. He spoke with RT Thursday and said that holding the elections before those effects are felt may favor Tsipras, but it's one of several factors which make the outcome uncertain.
People are basically primarily sick of the old political elite that ruled up to January, and I think Tsipras for the moment is benefiting from that. He's a new face, and people feel that, many people feel that he tried as much as he could to get a better deal. And again, the measures have not started affecting people's everyday lives, so that also helps him. Now, as to the base of the party, Syriza party, there is a lot of division there, and there are lots of people who supported Syriza who feel disappointed. So I would say that it's a mixed picture up to now, but I think time, once he starts implementing these tough measures, time will be counting against him and against the Syriza leadership. So that may be part of the rationale for calling elections. There haven't been recent polls in August. Usually polls are not carried out at that time because people are on vacation, they're not considered reliable. But before this before August, the last set of polls that came out after the agreement showed that Syriza is well ahead as it is, and it might actually be able to form to get a majority of the deputies in the parliament. So I think that's what the leadership in Syriza is hoping for, to basically win the election and be able to have a majority in the parliament, which they didn't up to now. They had a coalition government with a smaller right-wing party, and be able to continue implementing this tough agreement that you mentioned without having to rely on deputies from the left wing of the Syriza party, which are opposed to this agreement because it goes against the pre-election pledges of the party. The previous parties in power were sort of more willing to do whatever they were asked to do. The Syriza party is a little more unpredictable, or has been so far, partly because it has history of internal democracy. It is a party, a pluralist party of the left with different perspectives. And this has created the divisions that we see today. And this also divisions put pressure on Tsipras to try to resist as much as he could. And there had been discussions before the agreement was reached a few months ago that, the Europeans actually would want a split within Syriza where Tsipras, who was seen as more pragmatic, would get rid of the left wing of the party so that he could follow policies that were seen by the Europeans as more pragmatic. So I think it seems that in some ways this kind of scenario has come to fruition. There is probably going to be a split within Syriza. So that's, in a sense, a victory for the European side, as is the fact that, of course, Tsipras has been forced to continue austerity policies. But at the same time, it has to also be pointed out that there are divisions and tensions within the European side as well. And the hard line of the German government, which was considering even pushing Greece out of the Eurozone, has made it clear to other countries like Italy and France that if this were to happen to Greece, they might be next. And that's why we saw that the French and the Italians saw more of a backbone when it came to the negotiation of the Greek agreement, and they came to Greece's side, in a sense, trying to prevent the scenario of Greece being pushed out of the Eurozone altogether. The elections may lead to the split of the party. There was supposed to be an internal party congress to discuss the agreement and try to find a way of bridging the differences sometime in September. So a lot will depend on, when the date of the election is, whether there will be time to have, this party congress before that. Because I think, there are many different points of view within the Syriza party. There are people who are supporting the leadership. They're not part of the dissident left, but at the same time, they have they're not completely comfortable with the agreement and the continuation of austerity either. And this third party, so to speak, or this third group, has said that there has to be, a discussion within the party, so that the party can have an opportunity to plan a new strategy before there is an election. So if there is an election that happens very quickly before there is time for the party congress, this could not just lead to the split of the party, but it could create lots of discontent, even within the part of the party that stays with Tsipras. One of the things that was important for them was to make sure that this agreement passed through the European Parliament and that the first installment of the loan was disbursed so Greece could meet its immediate obligations to the European Central Bank. And the next important milestone would be the discussion of the debt and whether the terms will be changed, made more favorable so that the debt is more sustainable. But this would not happen after the performance of the government was evaluated, probably sometime in October. So there was a lot of discussion and a lot of speculation whether the government would try to do the elections now, immediately, before these measures sort of sink in and start affect people's pockets and change the climate against the government, or whether it would actually wait till October or November when there might be a positive agreement on the front debt, on the debt front, and that this might make it easier for Syriza leadership to have a positive narrative saying, see, we have gained something, there are positive prospects. The European leaders got what they wanted, which was continuation of the austerity policies. And from their point of view, that sends a message to other anti-austerity forces in Europe notably in Spain, that there is no alternative. So that's what has happened in Greece. Is for the moment, it's a bit of a setback for, you know, anti-austerity forces throughout the continent, that it may affect the elections that will be coming up in many other parts of Europe in the coming months.
Multiple exchanges of fire across the border between North and South Korea. An army spokesperson for South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff told the press briefing that the North fired provocative rounds of shelling twice. The DPRK shells were believed to have landed in hills near South Korea's frontline army units. South Korea's military said it fired back about 20 warning shots with its 155mm self-propelled guns at the area from which it said it believed the DPRK shells were fired. No damage or casualties were reported by either side. Border tensions have escalated after two South Korean soldiers were injured by the explosion of landmines on August 4th, which Seoul claimed had been planted by DPRK forces, but Pyongyang denied the allegation. About 2,000 South Koreans living in villages near the west border have been evacuated. The exchange of fire came after South Korea and the U.S. kicked off their joint annual war games called Ulchi Freedom Guardian on Monday. North Korea has denounced the games as a rehearsal for an invasion. The exercises are set to run until August 28th. Brian Becker is the coordinator for the Answer Coalition, which is organizing tours of North Korea for Americans later this year. He spoke with us from Tokyo via Skype Thursday, and we apologize for the quality of that connection. You know, the reports here that there's been shooting across the border back and forth, and an up-ramping of the hostilities between the North and South. Tell us what's going on.
There's a reported artillery barrage between North Korean and South Korean military forces along the DMZ. The 38th parallel that has divided Korea north and south since 1945. The big picture, which is missing in Western media reports, is that this is in the context of U.S. war games, war exercises conducted between or with the United States and South Korea that simulate the invasion and destruction of North Korea, an exercise which North Korea always claims is tantamount a declaration of war by the United States and South Korea. That's the big picture. It also takes place on the 70th anniversary of the end of the World War II. And as your listeners may know, when the Japanese government surrendered unconditionally to the United States on August 15th, 1945, one of the conditions imposed by the United States is that the Japanese colonial military apparatus remain in place in South Korea until Douglas MacArthur and the U.S. military forces could arrive, which they did in early September 1945. To take over South Korea. In other words, not a moment of liberation for the colonized people of Southern Korea, but a reimposition of a new colonial rule. So August 15th is a sort of a bittersweet commemoration here in Korea. I'm in Tokyo right now with Korean populations that were enslaved. Their generations before them were enslaved by the Japanese government, brought to Japan, and where they still live as second-class citizens in Japan. The occasion of the 70th anniversary to demand that the United States finally end the Korean War, sign a peace treaty with the DPRK, and begin the normalization of relations with North Korea. So all of the current military hostilities that had announced in the last 24, 48 hours take place within that context. And, of course, since August, the wings of the Korean government has been carrying out propaganda broadcasts in North Korea, which North Korea considers to be a provocation, calling for essentially the overthrow of the North Korean government. So what's going to gain headlines in the American media tomorrow or tonight is that North Korea launched a barrage of artillery shells, or maybe even just a few artillery shells, into South Korea. But it's important to have the context that the U.S. again is carrying out the simulated destruction of North Korea, which it does every 6 months, along with South Korean military forces. Korea remains an occupied country. 30,000 U.S. forces have occupied that country.
And from the perspective of self-defense of the North Koreans, the beginnings of these games and even the playing out of them looks exactly the same as an actual invasion, right?
Between 1950 and 1953, 5 million Korean people were killed as a consequence of the U.S. UN invasion of North Korea. The principal complaint of American pilots by 1951 was that there was nothing left to bomb in North Korea because there was not one structure taller than one story left standing as a consequence of the carpet bombing of this of North Korea. So when the U.S. carries out this simulated aerial destruction and invasion of North Korea, that's not like a video game sort of scenario. That's something that actually happened to the DPRK within the last 65 years. So, of course, the DPRK treats these war exercises as a declaration of war, as a repeat, a repetition of a monumental war crime committed against their people, and acts accordingly. So, again, the American media, distorted corporate-owned media that just is a mouthpiece for the military-industrial complex, won't give the American people the background to know that this is actually the context in which any current conflict or hostility that's taking place functions within. If you're a North Korean, if you're part of the Korean nation, if you have experienced a war in which foreign countries led by the United States invaded your country, 5 million of your population were killed, and that same government is simulating the destruction of your country again, you can't treat that as a game. It's not a war game. It is, in fact, a declaration of war.
If the international community doesn't take immediate measures to end the fighting in Yemen, there will be nothing left there to fight for. That, according to Stephen O'Brien, the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, and the top UN humanitarian official in the region, he made a report to the Security Council Wednesday.
Today marks World Humanitarian Day, commemorating the 19th August 2003 terrorist attack on the Canal Hotel, which served as the UN compound in Baghdad. The attack killed 22 people and injured over 100, most of whom were working tirelessly on the humanitarian relief effort in Iraq. Sadly, in the years since then, the number of people attacked while delivering life-saving assistance continues to rise. 10 humanitarian workers were killed in every month of 2014. In Syria, 77 humanitarians have lost their lives since the start of the conflict. In Yemen, 5 aid workers have been killed, others injured, and another 2 kidnapped this year. In the last 10 years in Yemen, 17 humanitarian workers have died in the line of duty, and 44 have been kidnapped. The contexts in which humanitarian workers serve around the world and the terrible plight of the more than 100 million people in need of humanitarian assistance they seek to reach continue to deteriorate. Madam President, I have just returned from Yemen, where the scale of human suffering is almost incomprehensible. I was shocked by what I saw. The civilian population is bearing the brunt of the conflict. A shocking 4 out of 5 Yemenis require humanitarian assistance, and nearly 1.5 million people are internally displaced. More than 1,000 children have been killed or injured, and the number of young people recruited or used as fighters is increasing. As I highlighted in my 28th July briefing on Yemen, the needs of the people are massive. This is exacerbated by impediments to commercial imports, resulting in widespread scarcity of food and fuel. Humanitarian assistance alone cannot meet all the needs of an entire country with a population of 26 million people. This is why airports and seaports need to remain open and be used for both commercial imports and humanitarian supplies without restrictions. Disregard for human life by all parties continues, with attacks on residential areas and civilian infrastructure having a disproportionate impact on the lives of ordinary people in Yemen. Reports of airstrikes and other shelling in and around Hodeidah port earlier this week damaged the main lifelines for the import of basic goods, food, medicines and fuel. These attacks are in clear contravention of international humanitarian law and are unacceptable. I am extremely concerned that the damage to the port of Hodeidah could have a severe impact on the entire country and would deepen humanitarian needs, making more people food insecure, leaving them without access to water or medicines, and which could also mean the spread of disease. Madam President, the parties to the conflict must ensure that humanitarian aid is facilitated and not hindered. All parties to the conflict must respect and implement international humanitarian law, and possible violations must be investigated and perpetrators held accountable. I have seen the anguish of the Yemeni people with my own eyes. Men, women and children alike, unsure where their next meal will come from or if they will ever feel able to return to their homes. In Sana'a, I witnessed queues for fuel which were kilometres long, with people waiting for several days to meet the basic needs of their families. I visited Al Thora Hospital, where the lights flickered as the generators were running low on fuel. Patients lay on the floor and cardboard was used as mattresses. There I saw a young man injured by shrapnel. He said he had been a soldier since he was 15 years old. I saw a young woman who was grazed by a bullet across her face while sitting in her own home. And I saw a young Somali man with tuberculosis. The hospital has run out of examination gloves and has insufficient quantities of essential medicines, as the supplier in Dubai is unable to fly their cold chain aircraft to Sana'a. Hospital staff informed me that the blood bank recently closed due to a shortage of laboratory reagents used for screening. In Faj Atan, a neighbourhood in Sana'a, I saw homes destroyed by airstrikes. Neighbours told me of the numerous civilian deaths and injuries. In Aden, an entire road of homes and businesses were destroyed by street battles and airstrikes, leaving the streets littered with tanks and unexploded ordnance. I heard the story of a father and his daughter being killed by an improvised explosive device just days earlier. The governor of Aden informed me that some people were slowly returning to their homes and basic services were being restored, but not in vast swathes of the city where unexploded ordnance litter the streets and buildings. People are overwhelmed by the scale of the destruction and the task ahead in rebuilding their shattered city. Electricity, essential for water pumping and cereal milling, is rare and intermittent. Madam President, it is appropriate on the occasion of World Humanitarian Day to reflect on the courage of my colleagues, Yemeni and international, who continue to deliver vital assistance despite the tremendous operational challenges, often risking their own lives to help others. Since the conflict began in late March, nearly 7 million people in Yemen have been supported by UN agencies and their partners, with food, water, shelter, health support and protection assistance. I am humbled by their tireless efforts of my colleagues. But much more needs to be done. We continue to scale up the humanitarian response so that we can reach all those in need with the assistance they so sorely need. This includes positioning more international staff across the country, outside of Sana'a and Hodeida. We aim to establish operational hubs in Aden, Ibb, Sa'ada and Mukalla as soon as the security situation allows. Madam President, the success of our effort to continue to assist the people depends on our having sufficient resources to respond. Today, the World Food Programme warned again that a lack of immediate and unhindered access to people who urgently need food assistance and the shortage of funding creates the possibility of famine for millions of Yemenis. To date, only 18%, some $282 million, of the $1.6 billion requested through the Yemen Humanitarian Response Plan has been received. UN agencies have still not received the funding from Saudi Arabia of $274 million pledged in April. Even once these funds are received, the response plan will only be funded at 33%. Substantial additional resources will be needed to support the Yemeni people through the rest of this year and beyond. Madam President, throughout my mission, I emphasise that peace is essential to ending the tremendous suffering of the people. There is no military solution to this conflict. Peace must be reached through a dialogue of words, not a dialogue of weapons. We, the international community, must match our actions with our words and take immediate measures to end the violence which is destroying the lives of millions of people across the country. We must get the parties to stop the fighting and return to the negotiating table before it's too late. Otherwise, there will be nothing left to fight for. Madam President, as we reflect on the state of play globally on World Humanitarian Day, we unfortunately see a worsening situation and a scale of needless humanitarian suffering that is truly shocking. We must act. We must do more to ensure that those of us in a position to prevent the abuses perpetrated against those who can do nothing are stopped, and that those who continue to carry them out are held to account.
Although the UN official now seems prepared to at least tacitly acknowledge that it's the past 6 months of Saudi airstrikes that's the cause of the crisis, some experts point out that the Saudi actions constitute war crimes against the people of Yemen. Edward Corrigan is an international human rights lawyer from Canada. He spoke with Press TV Thursday.
Well, it is a clear violation of international law, humanitarian law. In fact, I would even argue it's a war crime because you're imposing collective punishment on a civilian population, women and children, their innocents, and of course, the Saudis, backed up by their allies, but also supported by the Americans, are imposing an embargo on Yemen, preventing food and medicine and other necessary supplies to the civilian population. So this clearly is, as the United Nations and others have pointed out, a clear violation of international law. And you're looking at a humanitarian catastrophe that is largely man-made and preventable on a huge scale, because the Saudis want to impose their will and control Yemen and are supported by the feudal states in the Arab Peninsula, but also their allies, the Egyptians and even the Israelis that have been bombing Yemen and testing weapons. And I've seen or heard reports that they have using depleted uranium in Yemen. But you know, the United States should not be supporting these attacks. They're providing refueling, in fact, enforcing the embargo on Yemen. And the United States needs to remember that at one time it rebelled and fought for freedom against a monarchy and, you know, an authoritarian government. And they have lost that. Now we have the United States supporting, you know, feudal regimes, authoritarian regimes, dictatorships around the world for their own interests. And this is you know, a violation of their own historical record and history. And I think ultimately it's going to create huge problems for the United States because they're losing their credibility. They are supporting regimes that on face cannot be supported, like Saudi Arabia with huge human rights, like the Egyptian regime. But their policy also is chaotic and inconsistent, where they're supporting people on both sides of a fight, and they are, you know, trying to impose their draconian will on places like Syria, and of course, which we saw the destruction of Libya and Iraq, now we're seeing the destruction of Yemen. So any impulse of independence or freedom in the Arab world is being attacked by the United States, and far worse, is being attacked by these regimes that of course will not allow freedom and democracy in their own countries, but want to crush it in any other countries that's neighboring.
The Security Council also heard about the urgent need for action in Israel-Palestine, that from Undersecretary General for Political Affairs Jeffrey Feltman, as Stephanie Kutrix reports.
Reprehensible retaliatory violence, provocations at Jerusalem's holy sites, and a worrying increase in rockets launched from Gaza towards Israel. Those are some of the events the UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs said were recently witnessed in the Middle East. The coming days will mark the one-year anniversary of the conclusion of last year's Gaza conflict, during which nearly 2,000 people died. Jeffrey Feltman said 1 year on, the continued suffering of Palestinians in Gaza highlights the inadequacy of the global community's collective response.
I begin my briefings to you today with an appeal to political, military, community, and religious leaders on all sides to work together to reduce tensions, reject violence, and prevent extremists from escalating the situation and hijacking the political agenda.
Mr. Feltman added that violent incidents are the inevitable product of the failure to make the tough choices necessary to resolve the conflict. He said it is time to reverse what he called the perilous tide that the world is now facing and restore to Israelis and Palestinians alike the hope that is in danger of being stifled by those promoting hate. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.